All righty. We thought, brethren, that today, rather than, since we have such an unusual mix for services today, that in place of the sermon, I would go ahead and do the next installment of the Nehemiah Bible study. It's been a month since we did one, and if we skipped today, it would be 2 months before, or 2 months in between installments of the Bible study. So we felt it was very important to keep some semblance of momentum going in this regard. So that's what we're planning to do. I will have an interruption in the middle of this Bible study, but I can't tell you about that right now. Let's go ahead to the book of Nehemiah, chapter 2, is where we'll pick it up today. Just a quick reminder. Okay, we can go ahead and do this now. Before we start the Bible study, we have one special presentation that we would like to make, but someone had snuck out of the room, so we had to wait till she got back in to do this. One couple amongst us on December the 17th celebrated their 25th wedding anniversary, and they thought they could sneak it by us by not putting it on the calendar that came out during the month of December. So since we were gone for the last three Sabbaths, this was our first chance to be back and embarrass them, I mean, congratulate them for their 25 years of marriage. So we have here some beautiful flowers. And as we were singing that last song, Joe walked out the door. I thought, oh, great. I'm going to have to start the Bible study and then stop it, then make this presentation, and then start up again. So gladly she came in with the necessary beverage, and they're back now. So if we could ask Don and Joe to come forward. Don and Joe Pavlik have celebrated their 25th wedding anniversary. Congratulations. And this is for 25 more. So congratulations to Don and Joe for their anniversary. Now that we've thoroughly embarrassed them. 25 years. Wow. Don must have really robbed the cradle, huh? Joe saying, no, I robbed the cradle. Oh, no, that's not it. All right, very good. 25 years. Goes like a flash, doesn't it? Hard to imagine. All right, now we can go ahead and jump into our Nehemiah Bible study. Last time, again, since it's been quite a few weeks since we've begun the book, just a few background facts once again. Book of Nehemiah is a continuation of the book of Ezra. Ezra did the compilation of both Ezra and Nehemiah in the Hebrew Bible. They're a single scroll, so they're kind of one book in that regard. We would date this book around 445 B.C. and going into years following that. Oh, we don't know much about Nehemiah the man. We know that this took place about 140 years after the destruction of Jerusalem. So you go through the 70 years of the Babylonian captivity, you go through another 70 years, and that's about the time we're talking. There's already been two waves of immigrants coming back from Babylon to settle in the area of Judah and Jerusalem. One about 80 years prior to this, or 90 years or so, and then the one with Ezra just about a dozen years before this book. So that's the story. We've got Jewish immigrants living in this area now for 60 or 70 or 80 years, and a second wave coming in, and now a third wave comes along with Nehemiah. We don't know much about Nehemiah as a man. We know he was raised in Babylon, but we also believe that he was of the royal household and a descendant of David. So while he wasn't made king of Judah or Jerusalem, he was made governor. We'll talk more about that later. Nehemiah's name means the comfort of the eternal, or the comfort of God, or God comforts. And Nehemiah certainly was that. By his personage, by his faithfulness, he was a comfort to the Jews of the day, no doubt. The end of chapter 1, we left off discussing how Nehemiah was the king's cup bearer. We talked about how that was such an important position of trust and responsibility, that he was literally the one to make sure that the king would not be poisoned through his beverages that he had at dinner or through the food. So again, a very trusted confidant of the king. He would have been a part of many of the discussions that went along or around in the royal court, in the royal household. Some would say the cupbearer actually maintained the king's signet ring and held it in trust, so that when the king had an official proclamation, the cupbearer would bring the signet ring and he'd put his impression on that, and the official document then would go out from there. So similar to many before him, God placed him in a position of high office and responsibility. So he would have been similar to Joseph in some respects, similar to Esther as the queen, similar to Daniel as prime minister. Very high and important responsibility. And we also talked about how he would have the trust of the king and a personal relationship with the king. And we'll see how that comes out a little bit more here in chapter 2. So let's take a look at chapter 2. In verse 1, it came to pass in the month of Nisan, the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, that I took wine and gave it to the king. He was the cupbearer. We'll mention just a few small details about this verse. It says the 20th year of Artaxerxes. Artaxerxes was the current Persian Empire or emperor of the empire. So that would place us in the spring of the year about 444 B.C. So we begin in 445, 4 months passes, and we get into the beginning of 444 B.C. So this, remember, was the same emperor that allowed Ezra to go back a dozen years earlier. And we'll talk more about that as we go along. But one thing we should also mention as a sideline, a detail as we go, is the name of the month of the year is called Nisan. We understand that there were original names that the Jews applied to the months of the year early on in their history. God gave them a calendar. We see back in the book of Exodus, you remember, that God calls the first month Abib. He says, "This shall be the first of moons or months to you." So God set up this lunar calendar. He passed it on to the Jews for safekeeping, and they faithfully have carried it on to this day. During the time of the Babylonian captivity, new names were given to each of the months, and they were in the same tongue as they lived in the area of Babylon, so Aramaic names. So what we have is different names being given to the months during that time of the Babylonian captivity. So they have a Hebrew name, they have an Aramaic name, but it doesn't matter which one you use. Now, sometimes people get bent on the calendar, and they say, "Oh, see, everything got perverted in Babylon there, and they even have wrong names." Well, if that were the case, God would not use the names associated with the Babylonian captivity in the Bible. He would have called this Abib. "You can't call that Nisan, that's a perverted month." Well, no, it isn't. It's just the other language for the same name of the month. So don't get bent out of shape in regard to calendar issues. We believe that God, as Paul says, has given to the Jews these oracles to maintain so that we can have the months in their correct order and keep the holy days when God has assigned them to be kept. So if it was wrong for the names of these months to be used, or that they were incorrect, then God would not have inspired this name to be used there. So about 4 months after Nehemiah first hears a report about how bad Jerusalem is, he breaches the subject about his homeland with the emperor. So wine is being served, and he's about to go ahead and present to the king this issue. The rest of verse 1, we'll read verse 1 again. "It came to pass the month of Nisan, 20th year of King Artaxerxes." So we're talking in the spring, talking about the time of the Passover, the days of unleavened bread, either right before. Who knows, this could have been during the days of unleavened bread or right after, but it's in that first month of the year. It says, "When wine was before him, I took wine, gave it to the king." Then he says this at the end of verse 1. "Now, I had never been sad in his presence before." Boy, wouldn't it be great if our wives or husbands could say the same thing? "You know, my wife has never been sad in my presence." Wouldn't that be amazing? Okay, maybe that's a bit of a stretch. His point is that his job was to do what the king expected, to provide for him. And the thought was, when you're in the presence of the monarch, you should be so thankful and so blessed, and of course you're happy. You're with me. Of course that better make you happy. And sometimes in these kinds of circumstances, heads start to swell. And sometimes kings could actually come to believe that, wow, you're in my presence. You ought to be delighted. You should be so lucky as to be around someone like me. Now, maybe that was not Artaxerxes' attitude, but nonetheless, here's a man that despite trials and troubles and difficulties and his people being in captivity and his homeland being in shambles, he was able to be pleasant and cheerful around the king every single time. That's quite a statement. Quite an amazing thing that he was able to do that. Never sad, in spite of what had been going on. What an example of cheerfulness to carry out. Then, I think we ought to at least point out before we go to verse 2, that Nehemiah apparently was waiting for God to open the door to discuss this. He'd been praying about it for 4 months. There's no doubt that he'd been thinking about these things, had been preparing scenarios in his mind as to how he might discuss this very sensitive issue with the king. Because remember, this was the king that let Ezra go back, financed the temple being reconstructed, and getting all the Levites and the priests set up so the temple service could be going on. And then for some reason that's not discussed in the scripture, the king shut it down. In fact, even allowed, although he didn't necessarily give permission, he allowed the enemies of the Jews to actually come and conduct a military operation against Jerusalem, where they killed any number of people and ripped down the gates that had been set back up and burned them with fire. So the king apparently had assumed that the Jews were a part of a larger rebellion that had happened 4 or 5 years before this time, and as a result, they were not very much in favor. So Nehemiah might be breaching a subject that could be very sensitive. So he was waiting for God to open the door, waiting for that to take place. And I would suggest that we all would learn from that, that when we have something difficult that we have to breach with someone else, it's a good idea to ask God to open the door, to make it obvious. To say, I need to talk to you about this, but I'm going to ask God to make it obvious, to open the door. I can't tell you the number of times that we've prayed those kinds of prayers, and God would open the door. Something I need to talk over with someone, and as we're talking or chatting, they'll say, you know, this has always bothered me about this. And I find, well, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because there's something we need to talk about in that regard. And we can begin to breach those subjects and take care of those things. So here's Nehemiah. He's serving wine, and yet the emotion of his homeland being in ruins just was overwhelming to him. So verse 2, therefore the king said to me, why is your face sad since you're not sick? Now he knew him well enough that he's not sick. He's just down. He's just downcast over this situation. This, he says, the king, is nothing but sorrow of heart. So the king knew him well enough that he's not sick. He didn't stub his toe on the coffee table serving me wine. He's just down. And it's just so unusual to see Nehemiah in this circumstance. Such a close relationship was there that he could tell that Nehemiah was downcast as opposed to sick. But then it's an interesting phrase. At the end of verse 2, Nehemiah says this, so I became dreadfully afraid. You think, why would he be afraid? Well, probably for some of the reasons we've already mentioned. He's going to be breaching a subject, in essence, helping the king to see that his judgment was really bad. That he made a bad decision about Judah and Jerusalem. That he shut things down and allowed people to be murdered that should never have happened. So when Nehemiah, instead of saying, you know, king, you really messed it up. You blew it. I can't believe your judgment was so bad that you would make a decision based on such little information, lump my people together with those other rebels who were causing problems, and have people killed and progress destroyed as a result. I mean, he could have said those things. But, you know, you attract more flies with honey than you do vinegar. Now, again, why you want to attract flies, I'm not sure. But you understand the point. He approached it in such a way that the king might be able to understand, but he was afraid. Now, again, there was a close relationship there, but one of the admiring things or admirable things about Nehemiah is that he understood his position, his place. He knew he was not equal to the king as far as authority in the political realm. Now, spiritually, of course, he was probably much superior to the king. But he understood his responsibility. He was a man under authority. And he realized that just by being sad in the presence of the king, he could have your head. And then you ask the king something that shows the king's judgment was really bad, that he made a mistake. This could cost you your life as well. These people had in their authority your life. The power of life and death was in the king's hand. So Nehemiah could have been put to death for what he might say. So verse 3, he says to the king, "May the king live forever." Great start. He wants to be sure the king understands that I know who you are. I know who I am. I understand our relationship. And this is by no means a criticism of all you've done. May the king live forever. He wanted to show his honor, his faithfulness to the king, even though the king had made a bad judgment several years earlier. But then he says, "Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies in waste and its gates are burned with fire?" He approaches it in such a way as to elicit the king's feelings. In other words, the king understood how important family was. This generation to generation passing. Artaxerxes sat on his throne because of this generational passing. And to think about his father's or grandfather's tombs being walked on, rubble crashing down on them and being disrespected, was something that hit him. So Nehemiah approached that, saying in essence, "You know, my family heritage is just a mess. It's a shambles. People are walking on the graves of our great ones. It's just not right. No wonder. Why shouldn't I be sad in that circumstance?" So, as we mentioned, in faith, he went ahead. Nehemiah was taking quite a risk in putting this forward, because the king could have very easily said, "Oh, you mean to tell me this is my fault?" Could have taken offense at that. Sometimes people in high positions tend to be very proud, and as a result, this kind of thing could take place. In faith, Nehemiah went ahead and simply approached this issue, saying, "You know, the graves of my fathers are being disrespected. No wonder I'm sad." So he focused upon the effect that it had upon him. He didn't point the finger at Artaxerxes and say, "Look how bad you've been." He said, "This is what's happened to me. The graves of my fathers, the tombs of my fathers are in ruins. Why wouldn't I be sad?" So he focused on the common feeling that honoring those who've gone before is a good and a right thing. Our ancestors have a right to be honored in that sense. So verse 4, "The king said to me, 'What do you request?'" I imagine at this point Nehemiah's dentures probably fell out if he had dentures. It would have been a surprise. I'm sure Nehemiah had cooked up all kinds of ways to approach this, how he would say it, what Artaxerxes would say back, and then he'd say this, and then Artaxerxes would say that, and then I'd say this, and some of us are better at concocting these constructs than others. But he probably thought some of these things through, and he might have thought that he would have to defend various things now and justify certain things, but the only answer was, "What do you need? What do you request? How do we fix this?" So right off the bat, Artaxerxes felt for Nehemiah. Now again, why was this the case? We know it was the case because God intended it to be this way. God directed this. At the same time, if Nehemiah had been a lousy servant and a disrespectful individual for all these years, would the king's common feelings have come out like this? Probably not. So it was a sum total, in one sense, of Nehemiah's outstanding, consistent example of living God's way, and then this brought about this kind of result, this kind of response. "So the king said to me, 'What do you request?'" And Nehemiah apparently was taken by surprise that all this could happen just like that. So he says, "So I prayed to the God of heaven." Great example of being instant in prayer. Good example for us. There are times we should pause before we say a word and utter a brief prayer to God to be sure that our answer is right and is reasonable and is maybe kind or maybe measured or whatever the situation might call for. Romans 12:12 tells us that we should be rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing steadfastly or instant in prayer. So Nehemiah had been praying about this, no doubt, a lot up to this point. And now the actual instant of an answer had to be ready. So he prayed an instant prayer, and God gave him the best words to say for the time. Verse 5, I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, interesting, if it's your decision, and you approve of what I've been doing all these years, in other words, you can trust me, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. It's just not right for it to be in shambles there. So his plea certainly is to the king that I've been loyal and faithful. You can trust me. If your judgment agrees with that, let me rebuild the walls of the city. Let me rebuild the city where my father's tombs are. Now, his ancestors, it wasn't necessarily his literal fathers, although the kings of Judah certainly were buried there. And if he was descended from that royal line, this would literally be true as well as figuratively true. And he may well have had that in mind. It is interesting that later on, during the time of Christ, the sepulcher or the grave of David was actually referred to as being right there in the area of Jerusalem. So it could have been that Nehemiah himself was responsible for actually rebuilding an honorable spot for David's remains to actually lay. So he was literally rebuilding the tombs of his fathers. So that may have been the case. So verse 6, the king then said to me, with the queen also sitting beside him, we'll pause there for a moment. As we mentioned, the wine bearer, the cup bearer, would have been privy to many things that most people would not be involved with. The king and queen were sitting there together, which was unusual by itself, that the king and queen were actually together, as shown to us by the book of Esther. When the king wanted the queen around, he'd call her in. It wasn't like your household, where you're always together. Or maybe your household isn't like that. Hope it is. Where you're always together, you're doing things together, you're talking together, spending time together. Not so with ancient kings in this case. If he wanted the girl around, he'd call her in. She'd sit there for a while and be a showpiece. Then she'd go her way and go back, and maybe weeks or months before they saw each other again. So here's the cupbearer there with the family circumstance. He would have been privy to all kinds of discussions and give and take in family situations, as well as the court and the official political situations as well. So the king said to me, with the queen sitting also beside him, how long will your journey be? In other words, how long do you expect this to take? Yes, I think you should go. How long do you think it will take? When will you return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. So the king said, yes, I want you to go. How long do you think it will take? When will you be coming back? Now, we have this immediate approval. We have a time limit set up. Chapter 5 tells us that Artaxerxes named Nehemiah the governor of the area, gave him full authority over that area of his kingdom for the time being, but he expected him to come back. He was trusted enough that he would go and faithfully take care of that assignment, but he was trusted so much that he wanted him back in the court situation at a specific time. So it's interesting that he was given that leave and asked when he would return. And again, I'm sure Nehemiah was sorting through, what do I ask for? How do I talk about this? How do I get permission from Artaxerxes to do this? So how long do you think this will take? So Nehemiah had to have thought that out. Now, we're not told here or elsewhere in the book what that time period was, whether he said a year, whether he said 5 years, give me a decade, we're not told. But it must have been a fairly short period of time, a reasonable period of time for it to be a reasonable thing. We'll also mention that there were political issues involved with this as well. Now, we understand this to be God's direct intervention. God moved in the mind of the king of Persia to give Nehemiah the option to go so that Jerusalem could eventually become secure, so that Christ could eventually come to Jerusalem and come to the temple and fulfill the various prophecies that were all about Jerusalem and dying outside of Jerusalem and all the things that were going on there. This had to take place. We know God intervened. But there were also political situations that would have urged Artaxerxes in this direction. Now, those without faith say this has nothing to do with God. He was just carrying out a political agenda. You see, there had been a rebellion in that area of the Persian Empire 5 or 6 years before. And that's the time that the Jews were supposed to be a part of this insurrection. That's why the gates were torn down and they were burned and the city was not allowed to be completed. So Artaxerxes, thinking that if I send Nehemiah there, I have a strong ally, a faithful servant who will secure this area for the kingdom. That's certainly part of it, no doubt. But how did that all take place? Well, God orchestrated that whole thing. So people with faith see God's hands at work where other people without faith see only coincidence or the physical circumstance. And we can see that time after time in our lives as well. Oh, what good fortune that, dot, dot, dot. No, good fortune, there is no such thing as good fortune. That's superstition. There's God's intervention in Christians' lives. Oh, sure, there's time and chance, but there's God's intervention. So what may be for some people just good luck. I remember one person saying, you know, the stars must have just aligned for me. I said, what are you talking about? That's astrology. Don't, as a Christian, don't use that phrase. That's just not right. God steps into our lives just as he did here. There were physical circumstances that prodded Artaxerxes to do what God intended, but it was God's direction there. So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time in verse 6, then in verse 7. Furthermore, I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me for the governors of the region beyond the river, that they must permit me to pass through till I come to Judah. Now, each of these regions had its governor, its ruler, its monarch. They were all answerable, ultimately, to the Persian regime, but they each had a bit of autonomy to run the area as they saw fit. Now, others have always done that kind of thing as well. The Roman Empire was a good example of that as well, where each individual local leader had a certain amount of autonomy to make judgments about the things in their area, to make sure things ran properly. The biggest thing, usually, that the federal level of government, in this case the Persian government, would want, would be the tax money. As long as the tax money kept coming in and there wasn't a war there, you'd do whatever you want in that area. So Nehemiah, in making this trip, understood that he would be traveling through areas that were not Jew-friendly. And as a result, he would need a letter from the king that said, you better give me passage. This is from the big cheese. This is from the king himself, that they must permit me to pass through till I come. Because they had the authority to say, no, you're not coming through our land. You want to go to Jerusalem, you go some other direction. You're not coming on this road. So they had the authority to do that. So with this letter, he could freely pass in the most direct route directly to the area of Judah and Jerusalem. So this would be very helpful for safe passage. Others would let you pass through, but charge you a toll. So obviously he wanted to be sure that that wasn't the case either. So verse 8, in addition, what you see here is Nehemiah gets permission right off the bat. So you can kind of sense that we're on a roll. So since that was an absolute yes right off the bat, how long is it going to take? Let me ask for this, letters. And that was a yes right off the bat, so let me ask for, and he keeps going down the line and asking and asking, and the king keeps granting and granting. It's wonderful to see that God working with Artaxerxes' mind that way to allow that to take place. Verse 8, and as long as we're talking about what I need, how about a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he must give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel, which pertains to the temple, for the city wall, and for the house that I will occupy. How did some monarchs continue to keep people in subjection? Well, by controlling the natural resources. And if you control the forests, and nobody can take these huge trees and logs out of your forest to build their fortress, you can keep them subdued much more easily. So Nehemiah now asks for permission to be given these giant trees, these logs, to build parts of the city wall, to build parts of his home, parts of the fortresses, etc. And the king granted them, in the end of verse 8, granted them to me according to the good hand of my God upon me. And as we mentioned, those without faith see he was a good friend of the king. No wonder he got all this stuff. People with faith see God had to act in Artaxerxes' mind, even with a friend, for all these benefits and blessings to take place. Nehemiah never lost sight that while the king gave permission, it was God who provided these miracles, who made this happen in the way that it did. So supplies from the royal forest, from the treasury, to help build the walls and the defenses of the city. Verse 9 then. Then I went to the governors in the region beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now, it would not surprise me that Nehemiah traveled a rather circuitous route on his way to Judah to be sure that each of these rulers in that area saw the letter from the king, because he didn't want to have to deal with some of the upsets that would have come otherwise. So, verse 9, middle of verse 9, now the king had sent captains of the army and horsemen with me. So the king actually not only gave him royal treasury, forest issues, permission to travel, he also sent a military escort with individuals along with Nehemiah. So here you have the Persian flag flapping in the breeze as the horsemen ride into town. And this is somebody important. This is a Persian delegation. We better pay attention to it, etc. God set this thing up in quite an amazing way. So this detachment would help enforce something if necessary. Now that obviously would discourage those who had the Jews' worst interest at heart. When you have a Persian delegation from the king, letters from the king, we better not mess with Nehemiah and the Jews. And it should also be very encouraging to the Jews to see this all happening, that we have a letter from the king, we've got a military delegation, we've got all this permission, we've got royal forest supplies, etc., etc. Should be very encouraging to the Jews. Then in verse 10, every good story, and this happens to be a true story, of course, but every good story has its protagonists and its antagonists. And here you have Nehemiah, the protagonist, and he's trying to do what's right. And then you have the antagonists enter the picture in verse 10. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard of it, they were deeply disturbed that a man had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. And you don't get a more succinct description of Satan's attitude than that. A person who's disturbed that anyone seeks the well-being of the children of Israel. That's both physical and spiritual. The well-being of the children of Israel is something that's guaranteed in the Scripture. And so when someone supports Israel physically or spiritually, that upsets the protagonists, especially Satan himself. So Satan is inspiring these two gentlemen, as well as another one that's added to the mix later on. They're upset that anybody would show interest in helping the children of Israel, in this case the Jews that were in that area. Sanballat is called a Horonite, probably because he came from the area of Beth Horon. It's about 12 miles northwest of Jerusalem. So he probably oversaw much of this territory before it was assigned to Nehemiah. And it was certainly well within the Persian monarch's authority to simply say, I know you took care of this area before, not yours anymore, I'm assigning it to somebody else. And they would often be antagonistic toward each other as a result, but it was now assigned to Nehemiah. Sanballat was a Samaritan, so he would have been imported to the area north of Jerusalem about 150 years before Jerusalem was destroyed. So his ancestors had been brought from Babylon to this area, and he was one of their descendants. Tobiah the Ammonite probably refers to his ethnic background. He was from Ammon, or at least it's the area he came from. What is interesting about Tobiah is a Jewish name. So he may have been Jewish. He was married to a Jewish wife. His children had Jewish names. His children were married to Jewish women. So he may have been a Jew, or he may have been an Ammonite that was married into Jewish blood in many respects. Either way, he sets himself up as an enemy to Nehemiah. He opposes the work that Nehemiah plans to do, and sets himself up as an enemy of what God is planning to accomplish here. The Tobiads in history were known as an aristocratic family that were rich and influential before and through this period of time. So, again, he may have had Jewish roots, may have had, at least through marriage, had quite a bit to do with the Jews. And I think what may be of interest there is that even though he may have been of the same stock of the Jews, it did not overcome his lust for power and his greed to be on top. So, to say that blood is thicker than water may be true. Blood is not necessarily thicker than greed and lust. So he may have given in to those things. He wanted to be in charge, on top of the heap, personally enriched, and thought that Nehemiah would be a threat to that. So, verse 11, I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Nehemiah conceals his true intentions. Verse 12, then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, which was what? Repair the wall and fix the city. Nor was there any animal with me except the one on which I rode. So he hops on his horse, maybe a few others with him, and he goes out to inspect how bleak the situation on the wall really is. And he goes out by night to keep his intentions secret. Again, a good example of trying to be wise as well as faithful. Didn't want to let the cat out of the bag too early, which would cause some other problems. So verse 13, I went out by night through the valley gate, to the serpent well, to the refuse gate, viewed the walls of Jerusalem which were broken down and its gates which were burned with fire. As we mentioned, probably burned fairly recently, within the last few years. Verse 14, then I went on to the fountain gate, to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal under me to pass. So the rubble from the previous walls had stacked up so in such a mishmash kind of order that he had to get off the horse and hike through this rubble to really get a feel for where the wall was intact, where it had been torn down, and what would be necessary to fix it. Verse 15, I went up in the night by the valley, viewed the wall, then I turned back and entered by the valley gate and so returned. So he completes this whole circuit to see what was going to be necessary to fix it all. And we might mention that the wall during Nehemiah's time constricted quite a bit compared to the wall during Solomon's time. When the city was destroyed in 586, much of the outer wall was completely destroyed and carried away. So the city of Nehemiah's Jerusalem would have been much more akin to the time of David, a much smaller city. Some archaeologists feel that Nehemiah actually used some of the early walls of Jerusalem to rebuild, which would have been quite a bit further up the hill than the wall during Solomon's time. So exactly how that all worked is not necessarily important, but it is a smaller city than it was during the time of Solomon, by far. Verse 16, the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done. I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the others who did the work. So Nehemiah just kept this top secret, didn't want to get stopped and opposed before he got started. And he may frankly have taken a little time to figure out who he could trust and who he had to have on board to make this all happen. So he calls these leaders together. It says the priests, the nobles, the officials. He said to them, you see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lies in waste and its gates are burned with fire. In the end of verse 17, come, let us build the walls of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach. So he unveils the plan that his job there is to complete the walls and the gates. That's his primary goal at this time. Now, he was made governor of the area. He had complete authority to make decisions for the area based on the authority given to him by the Persian ruler. So He wants them to understand that we're the laughing stock of the area. We have this stain upon us. And as long as these walls are torn down, everyone's reminded about the stupid things our people have done to deserve this punishment. So he plays on a bit that we want to remove that reproach by fixing the walls. Verse 18, I told them of the hand of my God which had been good upon me, also of the king's words that he had spoken to me. In other words, he told them this is what God has inspired. This is what God caused Artaxerxes to proclaim. We've been given authority from Persia to rebuild the walls. We've been given wood or lumber from the royal forests to be able to do this. We have this military detachment to show the power of Persia is behind this. So he gives them all these details how God has stepped in. And they said at the end of verse 18, let us rise up and build. So what a great response. Nehemiah has this outstanding example. He always acknowledges what God has done. Any good done to him was because of God's intervention. The people recognize this, and their attitude is also outstanding. Let us rise and build. Let's get up. And what it says literally, let us rise up. In today's terms, we say, let's get off of our chair and start the job. And I would say, brethren, that we as a church are in much the same situation. That there's been a wall that's been torn down. The gates have been burned in one sense. It's a sad situation. But the time has arrived for us to rise up and build. To do the job that God has called us to do. To preach this gospel powerfully around the world. As much as God gives us to be able to do. Now is the time to set our hand to do this good work. So that's what it says at the end of verse 18. Then they set their hands to do this good work. God was blessing it. Their attitudes were right. It wasn't competition with anybody else. It was for the work of God. This had to be fulfilled so Jerusalem could be a viable city that Christ could come to. So all the prophecies regarding Jerusalem and Christ and the Messiah could be fulfilled at their proper time. So the attitude of the people is outstanding and they actually start to do the job. Verse 19, that's never without naysayers. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they laughed at us and despised us and said, what is this thing that you are doing? Will you rebel against the king? The enemies played the intimidation game. We're going to tell the king that the only reason you're rebuilding this wall is so that you can formulate a rebellion against Persia and go independent. That was not what they had in mind at all. But, as Satan is wont to do, he will imply things that aren't really the case to upset people, to get them worried, to get them fearful. So Nehemiah did not bite on that. Verse 20, so I answered them and said to them, the God of heaven himself will prosper us. As Mr. Franks has said, if the tree is good, the fruit will be good. That's what we want. We simply want to do what God says. We're not going to complain about others or throw stones at others. Let's just get busy and do the work God has given us. They weren't going to say, oh, Samaria shouldn't be a capital, or there shouldn't be anything going on in Ammon. They simply said, let's do the job we've been given to do. Let's rebuild this wall. Let's do the work of God. He answered them and said, the God of heaven himself will prosper us. Middle of verse 20, therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build. But you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. This is not your area. It's not your concern. Nehemiah knew that God's direct intervention was the only way that this would be successful, and he trusted God to do that. God would intervene, and God would work through his people to be successful in the rebuilding of the city wall. So while these foreigners had no real claim to the area at all, an outstanding attitude of the brethren attaching to the vision that Nehemiah had laid out, and the building would begin. Now, we don't have time to go into chapter 3, but we will whet your appetite a little bit about that. As you go through chapter 3, it is in one sense one of the most useless chapters of the Bible, some might think. All it does is list the names of people and the sections of the wall they were responsible to rebuild. Some people simply look, but that's all it is. At the same time, you'll begin to discover some very interesting things as you go through chapter 3. One is, there is not one single professional architect or builder listed. These were common, everyday people. Some of them were goldsmiths. Some of them were high-ranking individuals. Some of them were laborers from the farm fields in the country. They all came. They did their part. They did what they could. They all were used by God to build the wall. So what we begin to see is a truly inspiring thing that takes place when all the people of God unite in common effort to accomplish God's work. Great things can happen. So we'll just whet your appetite with that and cover that next time when we get to chapter 3.